The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
It's the way things should be. If we are holding on to that, you know, things change. So as that changes, we feel the distress of loss. We feel the distress of, it's not the way I want it to be. And so this notion of clinging is a big one in the Buddha's teaching in terms of things that are helpful for us to look at. Things that we cling to are helpful for us to explore and look at to help us see how our own minds are contributing to our struggles, our suffering, our unease, our dissatisfaction with the way things are. And one big area of clinging that the Buddha pointed to, and the more I explore this, the more I think it really is the big thing that we cling to, is views. We cling to ideas. And we suffer over ideas. Now, some of these ideas are maybe not so obviously ideas to us. And this is what I'd like to explore today, actually, is to begin to open your experience up a little bit to see if you can begin to recognize just how much views rule our lives. And often rule our lives in ways that we're unaware of. So I would just like to kind of explore the various kinds of views that we have, why those may be a contributor to our suffering, and some about how views are formed. So I think the views that are closest to home are those that are about me, right? The ones that are about ourselves. We have all kinds of opinions, views about ourselves, some of which we don't really take as views, but really take as fact, right? We think, I'm the kind of person who, or I am such and such. I'm a smart person. I'm a confused person. I'm a miserable person. I'm an intelligent person. I'm the kind of person who likes to be in nature. I'm the kind of person who likes to go to museums. So we have all kinds of views about ourselves. I mean, we define ourselves. We define ourselves by views about ourselves. Now, this isn't inherently a problem. In fact, in some ways, I think it's part of the way our minds work. I think with views in general, part of the way our minds work is that as we live in the world, we see certain patterns get repeated, and we may see in our own lives, in our own experience, certain patterns get repeated, and it's kind of expedient, perhaps, to think of oneself as being a certain way, it may be expedient to think of, well, that person is always late. You know, that we see that pattern happen over and over again, and so we kind of have a sense of, that's the way that person is. And so we hold these views about ourselves, we hold views about others, and it's not inherently a problem, but where it is a potential for struggle, for suffering, both for ourselves and for others, is in that, for instance, we feel this when other people hold us to a particular view. I mean, we really can feel this if, like in that example of, you know, so-and-so's always late. If somebody says that about you, you know, well, you're always late. You know, it's like, well, maybe that's true some of the time, but, you know, not always. And so views tend to create a box. They box us in. We have a view, a perspective of somebody, a view or perspective of ourselves, and we box ourselves in. It's easier to see when somebody else is doing it to us, but we do it to ourselves as well. We create limitations for ourselves based on who we think we are. I've told this story a number of times, but it's a kind of a good example of this. A view I held of myself for quite a long time was that I was basically miserable. I was a miserable person. And a lot of my experience confirmed this. And this is I think, what the way views work. You know, we get a view in our mind, and then we see the world through that view. This is, I think, one of the areas that views has the potential to create struggle or suffering in our lives, in that we're seeing things from a perspective rather than seeing things for how they actually are. So, for example, with myself, with this view, I'm a miserable person. So a lot of my experience confirmed that. In fact, probably having that view, my mind kind of looked for it. You know, it's like, where's the miserable in this experience? Well, where's the miserable in this experience? And if I did experience some time when I was not miserable, I was actually feeling, you know, pretty good, my mind would say something like, well, yeah, I'm happy now, but I know what I really am is miserable. So the mind created that box of identification and wouldn't really take in the possibility that something else was happening. You know, I could see that I was happy in that moment, but it didn't poke any holes in my identification with being miserable. It was just kind of like brushed aside. Well, yeah, happy now, but I'm really actually a miserable person. And then, you know, you can imagine what a mind like that would do. It would go off and start thinking about, well, what are the ways that I'm miserable? Oh, yeah, there's that situation. And, oh, that's not good. And, and within a very short time, make oneself miserable. So with perspectives like that, with views about ourselves, we box ourselves in. We limit ourselves. We also have views about not just like identities of emotional identities, but we also have views and opinions about ourselves and in our roles. So we have identities in roles. We have identities as parents, as children, as workers, as co-workers, as friends. And we have perhaps some ideas about what those roles are. One Dharma teacher, a mother, this was a story I heard probably about 15 years ago, but it really kind of stuck in my mind. She talked about how her daughter had done something that she didn't approve of or something like that. And what she saw at some point in her mind was her mind saying, I'm not the kind of mother whose daughter would do such a thing. And she had to laugh at that thought and say, you know, well, look again, you know, you are a mother whose daughter is doing such a thing. So again, you know, this view, we can hold views and create certain ideas about what those are and then suffer as those views are not measured up to, perhaps. We also have views about views that are formed more culturally, more with our society and our culture. And these kinds of views may be, I mean, with views about identities, I think we can usually kind of, maybe even right now as I'm talking, you might have thought about some of the ways that you have identities. You know, that you have perhaps an identity as a parent or as a child or perhaps some familiar habits or patterns of mind. You might have recognized some of those identities and maybe begin to looking at those as, well, okay, are those views or are those true? And that's one thing that I really want to encourage in this talk is to begin to look at those kinds of perspectives as a view. rather than as truth. For myself, you know, letting go of that idea I'm a miserable person as truth opened me much more to the possibility of seeing happiness when it came as having validity. So you might be able to kind of recognize in yourself some of your own habitual or familiar identities or views of this first kind of personal views. The second kind, cultural views, these are kind of more shared views that we have. And you know, we all live in a lot of different cultures. We may have cultures in our family. We have cultures in a school. We may have a culture in a community that we grew up in. And the way we are acculturated is, you know, it happens a lot when we're, especially the kind of cultures of our family and the cultures of our community, our immediately surrounding community. Those kinds of views get set pretty early in our lives. So we don't often have a lot of memory of those views being created. So things like, for example, you know, how close you stand to somebody when you're talking to them, whether or how much eye contact you make with somebody with a particular level of intimacy, how much physical contact is appropriate for particular kinds of intimacies. So those kinds of experiences are also views. Culture to culture, those kinds of situations differ. When I was in the Peace Corps, it was very common for two people of the same gender to walk down the street holding hands together. It just demonstrated friendship. In this culture here in San Francisco, it usually demonstrates something more than friendship. It demonstrates more of an intimate connection. Holding hands with somebody is a kind of an intimate thing to do. It wasn't that much so in where I was in the Peace Corps. It was a form of intimacy, but it also was just a form of friendship. So those kinds of things vary culture to culture. And we often don't see these things as views until we're in a situation where we are no longer surrounded by that comfortable agreement. We're no longer surrounded by that with people who behave in the same kind of way that we have acculturated to. One book that I'm reading now is an interesting exploration of this very topic around cultural views. It's called Culture as Comfort, and it explores how the patterns, these cultural patterns, become very comfortable for us. And then when we are uncomfortable in situations, it's worth looking at, is it a cultural thing that's happening if we're uncomfortable in a situation? If you go into a social situation and you find yourself uncomfortable, is it something perhaps that you don't know about the culture, or a feeling of not being familiar with the way people here are behaving? A simple example, you know, the very first time I went to a meditation group, you know, I went up to Spirit Rock, and you know, I was terrified. I was with somebody who'd been there before, so that helped, but it was like, you know, I don't know what I'm walking into. Am I going to make a mistake? Am I going to do something wrong? Am I going to, like, you know, people are going to point at me and stare or something? So I was uncomfortable moving into that situation where I didn't know what the culture was. And so the one interesting thing to explore is, if you find yourself uncomfortable in a situation, begin to look at what kind of perhaps familiar views are not being met. You're talking to somebody, and Maybe they're staring at you in the eyes a little more intimately than you're familiar with. You know, just that the discomfort there is, it's related to a view, not a very conscious view, but a view nonetheless, because it is certainly not, these things are not hardwired. These kinds of cultural differences are not hardwired. The cultural patterns are not hardwired in us, because cultures have so many different flavors to them. There's some other societal views, perhaps, that I don't know if they're more broad, perhaps more broad than a particular community. Things like in broadly speaking, in this country, there is a view that, this is the American dream, you know. Anybody who works hard enough can achieve their dream. There's a kind of a view that pervades our culture. And this view can lead to a kind of a blindness to the privileges that are given to a certain group of people, generally white people, privileges that are given to white people, and for a certain class of people, for a certain group of people, the white people generally, that may be true, that view may have some truth to it. And yet for a large group of other people, often people of color, there are structures in the way of that possibility. And so having that view, holding that view as a culture, creates views and opinions and beliefs about a whole group of people that are oppressed in ways that we may not be able to consciously see. So these kinds of views can create a lot of suffering. Another societal view that's got us in trouble with the environment. We have the capacity to use nature to produce things that we want, and therefore we have the right to use nature in that way. That could be a rough expression of a way that we consume resources. Because we have the possibility to do that, we have the right to do that. Earth Day is coming up. We can reflect on, just how much this view of consumption is almost inevitably going to lead to great suffering in the coming years. Unless we act soon. And then there's like metaphysical views. These are views that maybe I think are more perhaps developed later in life after the more rational mind has formed. So views about the soul, for instance, or views about rebirth, or views about whether there's a God or not, things like that. One of the dangers of views, and this, I think, this last one really reminded me of this. One of the dangers of views is that when people have differing views, there results, especially when people hold tightly to views around good and evil, God and what's right and wrong, around around particular beliefs around God, with people holding strongly to those views, the Buddha says quarrels and disputes result, but more than quarrels and disputes result. It results in people flying planes into the World Trade Center. It results in wars and any number of torture and all kinds of suffering because of, and in this case, you know, belief in the justification of that harm that's perpetrated. So one of my favorite quotes from the texts about views is about views. Those attached to perceptions and views roam the world offending people. That this, the attachment to views and opinions creates a perspective that will not admit other perspectives. And so the drawbacks, quarrels, fighting, murder, war. And the Buddha actually suggested a training around this. He said, refraining from quarrels is a good training in essentially exploring clinging to views. He recommended looking at, you know, if you refrain from quarreling, what it puts you back on is looking at what's the tension? What's the tension there? What is the view that I'm holding to? Is it a view that I'm holding to? You know, this kind of uncovering of views is a great... again, we often don't see our views as views. We see them as truth. And so if we find ourselves engaged with a quarrel with somebody, to begin to look at, or potentially engaged in a quarrel, if we can stop and look at what is the view here that I'm holding, or what is the perspective that I'm holding, and then see if you might be able to understand the perspective of the other person and begin to recognize there are different perspectives, there are different views on a situation. And so this is the biggest, or one of the biggest issues around views, is the outward suffering, the outward pain and harm, essentially real, true harm that can come from imposing our views on others. A more subtle danger that the Buddha pointed to around views is that we tend to, with views, especially with views of speculation, things that we think, oh well, I wonder about this or that or the other thing. You know, speculating on one of the classic. Places, or one of the classic series of views the Buddha pointed to, or that was in effect at the time of the Buddha. There were a number of different religious sects that each having all these different views. Some people would say, the world is finite. This is true. Everything else is wrong. Other people would say, the world is infinite. This is true. Everything else is wrong. Others would say, the world is eternal. This is true. Everything else is wrong. Others would say, the world is not eternal. This is true. Everything else is wrong. And these people saying these diametrically opposed things would end up quarreling with each other and spending time trying to shore up their arguments, you know, spending time in their minds trying to shore up their arguments for why their view is right. And this is another thing the Buddha pointed to around views. He said that when we are attached to views and speculating about the world, we tend to keeps our mind agitated and doesn't allow the mind to settle down and actually look at what's happening here and now. The Buddha came right into the present moment. He looked, I think, at views as being a filter on our experience, a filter through which we're kind of taking reality in. And that filter is actually obscuring what's really happening in the present moment. This happens all the time. We don't see just how often this happens. For example, something as simple as an agenda of what we're doing. And the psychological term for this is selective attention. It's a well-documented psychological phenomenon that when we have a particular agenda, our attention goes to that, to information that's relevant to that agenda. And we'll miss things that are not in line with that agenda. So we walk around the world, thinking that we're seeing things kind of like our eyes are like cameras and our ears are like microphones. They're picking up everything and we're hearing everything that's happening. This selective attention thing is sometimes called, in the auditory range, is sometimes called the cocktail party phenomenon, where you're, you know, having a conversation. There's a lot of noise in the room and you're having a conversation with somebody and suddenly you hear your name on the other side of the room. You know, your mind has picked something out of the kind of random noise in the room. So our attention will gravitate to certain things and not to other things. Our ears are not hearing precisely all the words that are being said in the world, in the room, but hear precisely our name. So this kind of attention. It's very natural that this is the way our minds work. It's not a problem that our minds work this way. In fact, it's actually helpful that our minds work this way. That, you know, like one day I was, or not one day, a whole period of time I was pulling Bermuda grass out of my garden. And at first, I had to really look for the Bermuda grass. You know, it's like, what is that Bermuda grass? And there's one chunk of really big patch of it, and I could pull all that up. But then I began seeing it was like in other places, and I kind of had to search for it. It was kind of weaving its way through the grass, and I was like, you know, finding the Bermuda grass. And it was a little bit of an effort initially to find the Bermuda grass. But then after a while, like, I would look across the grass and there the Bermuda grass would just like pop out at me. I would close my eyes at night and I would see the image of Bermuda grass. It's like the mind was really attuned to Bermuda grass. So we, you know, so it's a very helpful thing. You know, if you have a agenda, you have a task, that our minds kind of make it easier for us to do that is helpful. Where the problem lies is that We do believe that our eyes are recording things clearly, or, you know, purely, or our ears are recording things purely. And if somebody tells us or says to us, "Oh, such and such happened," and you were looking right at the thing, but you didn't see it. I mean, I've done this a lot of times. I mean, my dad, when I was a kid, he would always get on my case. Like I would be looking for something. And it would be right in front of me, and I wouldn't see it. And I looked there, And I even looked there two or three times. And then my dad would say, well, did you look there? And I say, no, yes, I've looked there three times. And he would drag me over there and point to it. It's like, clearly I wasn't seeing it. I wasn't seeing everything clearly. So the delusion or the problem around these filters is not that they happen, but that we don't recognize them as filters and don't recognize that we're not seeing things clearly. A kind of a poignant story about this kind of view. On NPR, I heard this story some years ago. A woman was raped, and a person was of a different race than her, and she picked somebody out of a lineup that and said that was that person that had raped her, and that person got convicted of the crime, went to jail. Into prison for a number of years. And then at some point, DNA evidence proved that he was not the person. But in her mind, I mean, it was confirmed to her that he was the right person because in her mind, every time she remembered the rape, she saw that person's face. And so the kind of, you know, there's an incorrect perception that happened. And then it's almost like memory gets rewired. So it was a view that was created from an incorrect perception. Fortunately, in this case, after many years, unfortunately, the DNA evidence proved that he was innocent. So views get formed in many ways. I think one of the key ways that views get formed is again culturally, in a way, views are formed by being told something repeatedly, either implicitly or explicitly. So a lot implicitly with respect to culture. You know, we are repeatedly put into situations and essentially taught how to stand, how to speak, how much eye contact to make, over and over again just by this repetition. Views can also be formed by being told something from what we consider to be a reputable source. You know, history books are a reputable source, we think. And, you know, we read history and we form our view of history based on that reputable source. And I'm reading a book right now. It's kind of an interesting exploration of the history around Richard III. I don't know if any of you are familiar with the history of Richard III. He's supposed to be the hunchback evil king of England who murdered the two young princes in the Tower. You may know the story. But in any case, so that was in history books. I don't know, it may even still be in history books, but this book that I'm reading fairly convincingly clears Richard of any wrongdoing at all. So, you know, we're told something over and over again. You know, Shakespeare wrote the play. You know, it's like we all see Shakespeare. And, you know, we get that view of history. We get the view of history from our history books. And we're told over and over again, this person did this, and we believe it. Oh, when I was a kid, I was in an art class, and the teacher, we were learning to draw apples, and she was really great at helping us do the gradations of color. You know, she was really clear on helping us do. And we could make some very beautiful pictures of vegetables and fruits and things with a lot of clarity and depth by the way she taught us to use the shading of the colors. She was really great on color, but not so great on form. Because whenever one of us would draw an apple that was not perfectly round, she made us redraw it. And she said, apples are always perfectly round, or something like that. And, you know, we're sitting there going, what? You know, we've seen hundreds of lopsided apples by the age of 8, which is about how old I was at the time. And he's like, we'd seen so many of these lopsided apples. It's like, what is she saying? And one day, even a kid went in and he put one of those really lopsided apples on her desk. And she didn't say anything, you know. It's like, she still kept this, you know, apples are perfectly round. And one day when I was, you know, I've always been mystified by this. I had been completely mystified by this for the longest time. Like, how could she possibly think that, right? How could she possibly think that? And at one point I was, this was just a couple years ago, I was cutting an apple in my kitchen, and I tend to cut the apple along the line of symmetry, you know, where you cut it and it falls into two roughly equal halves. You know, maybe really lopsided on one side, but there's roughly a line of symmetry where, you know, it falls apart and looks kind of even. And it occurred to me as I did that, I remembered, this teacher kind of popped into my mind, and I thought, oh, you know, maybe somebody told her, or she learned in some biology class, that apples grow symmetrically. You know, that there's a line of symmetry, or there's symmetry in nature or something, and that she misunderstood what symmetry is to be perfect. I don't really know what happened, but this was an interesting way to think about it. And then what occurred to me is that she couldn't see apples that were not, it just like that apple that was not symmetrical just was not taken in because it didn't fit her view. This is a perfect example of that kind of screening that we do, that our minds do. We see things that confirm our views and don't see things that don't confirm our views. We also, views form out of our own experience. And this is, I think, a large place where views form. The classic story of this is the blind people and the elephant. Is it 9 o'clock or is it 8:47? It's 8:47. Okay. That clock is wrong. Okay. I was, oh my gosh. I'm not going to be able to tell this story. Okay. The blind people and the elephant. The classic teaching story in the suttas of blind people who are shown an elephant, shown various parts of an elephant, and then asked to describe the elephant. And of course they give widely different descriptions. Some people describe the elephant as being like a post, others like a wall, others like winnowing baskets, others like a hose, others like a broom. Now, that itself isn't a problem, right? I mean, because they were each shown a particular part of the elephant. Their description of the elephant was corresponding to their experience. But the teaching story goes on, and this is a teaching story, so, you know, the teaching story goes on that when they each heard the descriptions that they gave, that they came to blows fighting about, no, an elephant's not like that, an elephant is like this. Now, it's a kind of a silly thing to quarrel over, but this is a kind of thing that we do. We quarrel over perceptions, essentially. In this case, this is a perception that's correct, but not the whole picture. So, you know, an example of this kind of perception that develops based on our own experience over and over again is happiness comes from getting what I want. That we over and over again get a sense of pleasure, of delight, of ease when we get something that we want. And so over and over again, that's confirmed. And we begin to have the belief that that is the only way to have happiness when we get what we want. It's one way to have happiness, and the Buddha points to it and says, yes, there's a happiness that comes from getting what you want, but it's a pretty paltry kind of happiness, he says. It's a happiness that is dependent on the having. It's dependent on the impermanent things that come and go. And so the happiness itself has got to be impermanent, because that kind of happiness is dependent on things that themselves are impermanent. So this belief, this view that's created, happiness comes from getting what I want, is only a part of the picture, and it's not even a very what's the right word? It's not even a very deep kind of happiness that comes from that. It is a form of happiness that comes from getting what you want. There's a deeper form of happiness that comes from equanimity, that comes from being at ease with things as they are. There's a deeper form of happiness that can come with the disappearance of wanting, of craving, the disappearance of feeling like I need to have that thing. That craving is telling us we have to have that thing. And yet, if you hang out with that craving for a little while, watch it go away, you find that when the craving goes away, there's no problem anymore. Happiness actually can come from the release from craving. So one of the keys, I think, for us in exploring views is to begin to recognize them. We're not probably going to simply be able to, stop having views. I mean, they seem to be embedded in our human nature. Having views seems to be embedded in human nature. If we can begin to recognize them as views rather than fact, rather than truth, there's a power to that. There's a power to recognizing a view as a view. Recognizing, for instance, I've used this a couple times this week, because this has been a kind of a theme this week, and exploration around views has been something that's been revisiting my teaching this week. So in doubt, for instance, my mind is believing I can't do this, or I'm no good at this. That's a belief. It's a view. And yet very often views like that are taken to be true. It's fact that I'm no good at this. It's fact that I'm a failure. And so the acknowledgement of it as a view, I mean, sometimes people in relationship to views think, I'm not supposed to believe my views. And I found that actually that is may not be the most helpful approach. Because something like that, an entrenched view around I'm a failure, sometimes the mind believes it so deeply that trying to tell yourself it's not true it's just running so against what's already happening in the mind that the mind is just going to brush it off. It's like, yes, I'm a failure. Well, no, you're not a failure. Oh, yeah, right. Yeah, you know what you're talking about. I mean, that's what my mind would do with that. It's to try to deny what the mind is deeply believing and believing as fact, to try to say, well, that's not true, to try to not believe it. Generally, you know, we can't, it seems to me at least, that we can't just flip our beliefs. We can't just say, I'm not going to believe that anymore. I'm not going to believe anymore that I'm a failure. I mean, the mind just isn't quite that easily led. And yet, what I have seen the mind is willing to do is to acknowledge there's the thought that I'm a failure, and believing is happening. I believe that thought. Believing is happening. So the acknowledgement of it as belief opens the mind's perspective just a little bit to recognize it as a belief rather than fact. It's true that that belief is happening in the mind in that moment. It is true that that thought is arising in that moment. It is a phenomenon arising in that moment. And so with mindfulness, we can acknowledge there's a thought arising and there is believing of that thought arising in the present moment. This is a huge support for beginning to open the to loosen the tentacles of belief, the grip that belief has in our mind, because that kind of, it's delusion to believe some of those kinds of views, and the acknowledgement of it, okay, that belief is arising, is bringing the mind into alignment with truth in the moment. This has had quite a helpful impact for me in various areas where certain beliefs were strong. I would kind of at one point just kind of look at, oh, there's a thought, and just kind of check in, how much do I believe that thought? Sometimes the belief would be strong, sometimes it wouldn't be so strong. I'm going to leave a couple minutes. I may not have a couple minutes for questions, but so one thing to recognize or to know is that any time there is a kind of suffering happening, any time there's some struggle, there's also some view that is paired with that struggle. And so it can be interesting to kind of explore that a little bit, question it a little bit. Often the beliefs or the views that are related to the suffering are kind of buried. So, an example of how you might explore this or something along these lines, like looking at what are facts in a situation and what are beliefs. So, for instance, if you're having a conversation with somebody and they make a funny face, and you immediately attribute that funny face to being some kind of, you know, they don't like me, or they don't like what I just said, or they don't, something like that. So what are the facts and what are the beliefs? So beginning to check into that. Well, the facts are I was speaking and that person made a funny face. The belief is the person doesn't like me, or the belief is that person doesn't like what I said. Acknowledging that as belief. And then take it further. Suppose it actually happens that the person doesn't like you. Is there suffering that results from that? You know, are there beliefs around that? Just checking in sometimes. If there is suffering, you could ask yourself, what beliefs are operating here? What beliefs are operating here? So, you know, if in fact a person doesn't like you, if you get some kind of confirmation of that, and then there's a sense of suffering around that, you know, what's the belief? If somebody doesn't like me, I'm not a good person. If somebody doesn't like me, they're stupid. What? Whatever. If there's any kind of struggle or suffering, there's some belief operating. Now, you may not find it. You may not be able to see what the belief is. And so, you know, there's an exploration, a teaching that the Buddha offers around exploring suffering is essentially the same process by which suffering is created is the same process by which a certain kind of view is created, a certain kind of view of who I am. And so in exploring suffering, we are exploring that view, those identities, those perspectives that we have. So if what you're seeing is suffering and you can't see the view that's there, you can't see a belief that's kind of associated with it, that's okay. You don't have to like dig and try to figure it out. Just meet the suffering. Meet the experience. There is some kind of belief operating. Sometimes we can see it, sometimes we can't. If we can see it, sometimes it can help to kind of open the crack for us to recognize, oh, there's a belief, that belief. And sometimes our beliefs are just like ludicrous when they're exposed. And now I do have to stop. So I'll just say one last thing. Views themselves are not the problem. Views actually help us to navigate our social lives, our personal lives. But what is a problem is holding to views, believing that a particular perspective is right, and dismissing other perspectives as wrong. And the problem also arises when they are not seen as views, but they're seen as truth. So, thank you.